The Guardian.
I was a writer who had a very slow start, and all around me there were contemporaries of mine going past like bullets, you know, people like Ian and Martin and Julian. All these people seemed to find their way as writers almost immediately, you know, and when they were still in their 20s. And I felt like I was stranded on the starting line. So when I finally managed to finish Midnight's Children, I wasn't at all thinking about huge success. You know, I was thinking that, you know, as far as I could tell, this was a good book, and I hope people would agree, and that a few people who were not related to me or friends of mine would buy it. And that was the limit of my, if you like, commercial ambition for it. You know, and the thing that I've since come to think about it is that I think there was a moment there in the end of the 70s and the first half of the 80s when something happened to what readers were looking for in a book, that the reading public became more adventurous. You know, that it wanted difference. It wanted stuff they hadn't read before. They hadn't heard those stories. They hadn't, you know, they hadn't listened to those voices. They wanted novelty, if you like. And I think a lot of us who were lucky enough to be in that generation benefited from that desire of readers, and I think critics, for what you could loosely call originality. You know, and I think that's certainly what happened to Midnight's Children, is people seized on it as containing something they hadn't previously heard. I mean, but very differently in different parts of the world. You know, so for instance, in England and America, I guess, when it came out, people responded most openly to its sense of fantasy, if you like. Whereas in India, people read it like a history book. And I mean, I remember the thing I've always remembered is there's some moments, you know, which one can't forget with the publication of that book. There was a young man in India came up to me. I was there not long after the book came out. And he said, you know, I could have written your book. I know all that stuff. I mean, I decided that it was a compliment, you know. And what he was telling me was that the book somehow articulated an experience that was also his. I mean, I think the most moving thing, I remember the first literary reading I ever did in my life was for Granter magazine when Buford was just started editing it. Midnight's Children was in, the first two chapters of Midnight's Children were published in Granter 3. And at that point, Granter was still based in Cambridge in tiny offices upstairs from an art gallery. And Bill persuaded the art gallery to allow him every so often to hold readings in this art gallery after it shut. And he asked me to come and do one. And, you know, nobody knew who the hell I was. And so we thought maybe a few people will show up and that would be nice. And instead there was this colossal crowd, and a lot of the crowd was, you know, ethnically Indian and Pakistani and very excited about the book. And I always remember this woman who stood up, rather grand lady, with very, very well-dressed, with jewellery and stuff. And she said, thank you, Mr. Rushdie, because you have told my story. I thought, if you can do that, you know. It was the most moving thing, really. It still is. I was just telling you the story. It's moving. There was a feeling, I think, amongst Indian readers that it told a story that they hadn't heard told before. And the thing that happened with it still happens. The people who liked it most were young readers. I mean, when it came out first, it had a colossal success in universities and so on and so on. And it still does. I mean, the thing that I thought was interesting about the Best of Booker thing is how young the voters were. And I thought it's really something that people who were being born when the book was being written should still find it relevant.
Would you be resistant to the idea that, I suppose I felt this a bit rereading it and having forgotten quite a lot of what little I knew about Indian, the history, particularly about the history of the relationship between India and Pakistan, that actually there's something, it's the kind of narrative method that you use actually makes it, for the reader now, perhaps for the non-Indian or non-Pakistani reader particularly, makes the history, I mean, the history becomes very easily sort of metaphorical, so you don't feel all the time.
I hope so, because it's a real problem. I mean, the thing is, anybody who ever tries to incorporate particularly contemporary history and contemporary political material into a novel, it's a very frightening thing to do, because you know that, you know, the subject always changes. Whether it's next week or next year or 5 years' time, these will not be the things that people are exercised about. And you worry that at that point your book may lose value. Mm. You know, when it loses the appeal of the topical, you know, that it could, that people think, oh well, you know, it's, that book is no longer relevant. So the thing that certainly I spent a lot of my time thinking about was how to use that historical material in a way which, if you like, in a way that was novelistic, you know, in a way that was just so integrated into the action of the book that when this stuff faded from topicality, it would be just seen as being a part of the narrative line, you know. And if I could do that, I thought it would have a chance of surviving. I mean, you mentioned the emergency. Well, the emergency was a very big issue at the time that the book was being written. And, you know, it was India's one falling away from democracy. It was a period of just under 3 years when Indira Gandhi essentially instituted a kind of soft dictatorship. Well, not that soft, actually. And at the time, many people were very exercised about it. But I knew even then that there would come a time when she was no longer prime minister, and it was ancient history. And all I could do was hope that I had done enough that when the topicality faded away, if you like, the novelistic virtues of the book would take its place. You know, and I remember saying to people that this book, you know, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, this book is either going to get better or it's going to get worse. And the truth is, I didn't know which it was. You know, that I thought all that can happen is that I can do my best.
Because there's some quite minute sort of party political, yeah, you know, yeah, stuff in it about, which I think an English reader, even at...
would not get,
who
yes,
kind of watched the TV very closely and read the newspapers at, yeah, the time would kind of... But I mean, I suppose...
If you want to know that, you know, the intricacies of the Indian Communist Party...
Yes.
You know, the official Communist Party... the CPI brackets M, which is the Communist Party brackets Marxist, yeah, and the CPI...
The Naxalites, I'd forgotten
the
about
CPI
that.
Brackets ML, which is the CPI, Communist Party of India brackets Marxist-Leninist. And then, you know, there's this joke about Bengalis that if you have two Bengalis in a room, you have two political parties. You know? if you have three Bengalis in a room, you have three political parties, all of them on the left. And so it becomes... I just thought... treat it as comedy, you know, treat it like that. That this kind of endless breakdown of the left into these groupuscules that all hate each other more than they hate anyone else. If you treat it as comedy rather than politics, then it becomes, as I say, novelistic, you know, and that's what I tried to do.
And when you were, I mean, formally when you were writing it, did you, I suppose in a way you've perhaps answered this by saying that you weren't expecting very many people to read it. But I mean, did you feel that it was a kind of novel that was not in its content taking risks?
Yeah.
And that's what people talk about, but in its
Yeah,
in
I
its
felt
shape.
I felt I was taking the biggest artistic risk I could think of taking. That's what I thought. And part of that has to do with the sort of relatively stumbling beginnings of my writing up to then. You know, that I'd had one novel published that, to put it mildly, didn't do well, and other abandoned manuscripts, etc. So I was feeling pretty low about my plan to be a writer, you know, and strongly considered stopping, you know, and just going on writing advertising commercials and things, and being much better paid, you know, than novelists were. And I remember giving myself a talking to and saying, you know, when you're 60, now I'm 61, but 60 at that point seemed impossibly far away. It seemed like, as if one might say, when you're 200, you know. I thought, you know, if you give up after publishing one novel, you're going to be really sick with yourself. You know? And so I told myself, okay, now there's a couple of things you can do. You can either narrow your horizons and write a safe little conventional novel that's the opposite of risky, a kind of risk-free, middle-brow Hampstead novel, you know. Hampstead. or you can write the most challenging, daring, audacious, dangerous, you know, impossible to pull off thing that you can think of doing. In other words, you know, go for broke. You know, put everything on number 11, you know. And I thought, okay, I'll do that. Then I thought, what would that be? And the answer to that was Midnight's Children. Fortunately, my number came up.
I don't know if you'll agree with this description, but I wanted to ask you about one, perhaps a particular example of something which seems to me very much in 1981 and still narratively unusual and audacious about it, which is that whilst there is a chronology, tick-tock to it, of course, and a march of events, public and private as well, it also seems to be a novel which is quite fearlessly things and events, quite fearlessly connected metaphorically, I suppose. And the narrator talks about that, Salim talks about that a lot. And I noticed that the latest paperback edition actually has a pickle jar.
Finally!
Has a pickle jar.
I thought, finally, after all these years, they put a goddamn pickle jar on the cover. The most obvious cover for Midnight's Children. What I thought was, I used this to myself anyway, this idea of the leitmotif, you know, the recurring thing. It can be a phrase, or it can be an object, or it can be a gesture, or it can be just something that recurs, which in itself has very little meaning, but which acquires meaning by the number of situations in which it takes place. You know, I mean, so for instance, the spittoon in Midnight's Children. You know, it's just a spittoon. It's all it is. It has in itself, intrinsically, it has no metaphorical meaning. It acquires meaning because of the situations in which you find it. You know, and it becomes the receptacle of all those moments until it represents all of them put together. And I thought, because I was just thinking about all kinds of strategies for how to unify this enormous book, you know, this enormous weight of material that stretches over more than 60 years and, you know, has a very large cast and all kinds of event and, you know, digression and all kinds of byways, how to knit it together, you know. And of course, it has one piece of architecture, which, as you say, is the connection with history, the way in which the lives of the characters connect to the previously existing march of history. It has another piece of architecture, which is the structure of the family inside the novel, and that becomes a kind of skeleton. But this other thing, I thought, was in many ways the most important, was that to find these things which put together will provide a constant and structure of internal echoes in the book, which will help people feel what it means. I mean, the idea of the fisherman's pointing finger, for example, the picture of the boyhood of Raleigh that hangs on Salim's wall with the finger pointing into the future. That finger recurs throughout the book, either as a blood, as a pan stain in the dust, or he himself loses his fingertip, etc. So the idea of that, the finger that points, you know, and shows you the way, if you like, became one of those devices, you know. And so these were very conscious. And of course, the pickle jars are the overarching, super device.
So that, that seemed like, there's a great bit in the last chapter, Abracadabra, where Salim records a taste of pickle, and he says, and it's sort of important into resolving the plot because he says, "Oh, who made this?" Doesn't he?
Yeah.
And it turns out to be Mary Pereira under another name, but he says, "Oh, it had the power of bringing back the past as if it had never been away, kind of a pickled version of Proust."
This is this is curried Proust.
The pickle thing does seem a kind of comic, you say, you know, things which haven't got any meaning in themselves, but it does seem to have a meaning in itself. It does suggest that in sort of small ways, in a novel, which is often celebrated for sort of swirling fantasy, that preserving memories is actually a kind of, you know, Wordsworth said a holy thing, but I mean, without going so far, is a sort of a very important thing.
Well, it's the thing I was trying to do. In fact, when I was, I guess, in the beginning of thinking about the book, I mean, to put this in very inflated terms, I was thinking more in Proustian terms. I mean, that idea of the lost time, you know, you eat the Madeleine and it brings back the past as if it had never been away. You know, it's not memory, it's something beyond memory. Yeah, yeah. It's the actual recovery of the lost time. And that's what Proust, in his great novel sequence, tries to do. And I guess originally I thought maybe that was something like what I was trying to do. But then I kept discovering myself running up against this other problem, which is the erratic nature of memory. The fact that even when you're remembering, you know, your own life, your own childhood or whatever, you don't remember it properly. You know, you misremember it. And the misremembering becomes, in the end, becomes more important than the truth. I mean, I remembered one of the things that gave me a clue about this is I was thinking there's a chapter in the novel which deals with the period when India and China went to war. And I remembered this very vividly, very vividly. As a child, I remembered thinking there was this moment when everybody in India was frightened because it was clear that the Indian army was being defeated in the Himalayas and that the Chinese were coming over the mountains. And people were afraid that, you know, we got rid of the British and now we're going to have the Chinese. And I remembered my father and his friends talking about maybe we should buy Chinese phrase books and things like that, you know. And then the Chinese army stopped because all it wanted to do was to take the high ground in the mountains, and it didn't. And so there was never an invasion, and everybody was very relieved. And I remembered this with intense vividness. And then when I was talking to my parents about it, they said, what are you talking about? You weren't here. You were at boarding school in England. I said, no, I wasn't. They said, no, because you said this and she said that and, you know, Uncle so-and-so said this. And they said, no, we told you about it afterwards. But actually, at the time, you were at rugby school. And I was bewildered by this. And I went away and looked at the dates. And, of course, they were right. Yeah. You know, I had not been in India when this happened. And yet, even when I was confronted with the truth, my memory refused to unscramble. It would not unscramble. I still remembered the way I remembered the way I remembered. You know, that was it. And so I thought, okay, that's the strategy for the novel. Not in search of lost time, but memory, faults and all. All of that. You know, the erratic nature of remembering became a part of the strategy of the novel. And so it became a novel about how we remember, you know, about how we remember and what we remember and how we misremember and what all that does to the way in which we see the world.
Right, this is sort of a two-pronged question. One is actually to do with cinema, which you started talking about. And I wondered in how far cinema becomes part of the narrative drive of the tale. I mean, there are references to Salim's nightmare with the widow appearing green and black and black and green, which sort of seems to allude to The Wizard of Oz. There is also Vijayantimala. There are references to Bollywood cinema, Bombay cinema, as it was called at the time. And the other part of that question is in how far that spills over into your other novels. There are so many characters from Midnight's Children that seem to appear elsewhere, like Homi Katrak in The Ground Beneath Her Feet. You've got baby Adam appearing in The Moor's Last Sigh, and I think there's also reference to the Landowner Ghani in Shalimar the Clown. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about that.
Too big.
I've always said that I think it's true that the movies have been at least as big an influence on my writing as other books have, you know, and part of that is to do with growing up in a movie city and having it going on all around you. And part of it has to do with the fact that when I was young, when I was thinking about the kind of writer I wanted to be, I was lucky enough to be young at the kind of great moment of world cinema of the 60s and 70s, the French New Wave, the Italian New Wave. And not just that, but world cinema, you know, Kurosawa, Satyajit Ray, Ingmar Bergman, Miklos Jancho. I've said often, but I'll say it again, that it's very hard now to convey what it felt like when those movies, which now are the classic movies of the sound cinema, were that week's new movie. You know, where you went to the cinema and there was this new movie called 8½. You know, and the week after that, the new film was the new Kurosawa, and the week after that, it was the new Bergman, and the week after that, it was the new Ray, and the week after that, it was the new Godard, and the new René, and the new Truffaut, and the new Visconti, and the new... You know, it was exhilarating to go to the cinema and see these films, which are now justly, I think, the classics. And they taught me an enormous amount. I mean, there's a scene in Midnight's Children which can only be understood if you've seen a lot of movies. There's a scene where Salim sneaks into his mother's car and follows her to her assignation with her ex-husband, who he believes wrongly that his mother is being unfaithful to his father. And they go to this cafe, the Pioneer Cafe, and he's outside. You know, he's in the street with his hands pressed up against the glass, which is actually described as a movie screen. And they're sitting at the other end of the cafe. You know, so. And he describes this movement of their hands where they can't quite bring themselves to hold hands, you know, and so their hands keep not quite holding each other. And he finds this so upsetting, what looks like his mother's infidelity, that instead of looking at the hands, he looks below the hands to the cigarette packet on the table. And he describes in enormous detail the cigarette packet, the writing on it, etc. He's outside the restaurant. You know, it would be realistically impossible for him perhaps even to see the cigarette packet, let alone to describe what's written on it. The only way we can understand it is because we see it immediately as a close-up. We see it as a cut-in, cut, you know. And because we're all trained in film language, we all see what's happened. You know, you don't even have to say it. You know, it just immediately our imagination goes into close-up and we see what he's doing. So there's all kinds of ways, I think, in which film language has allowed us now as writers to use techniques which would, you know, 100 years ago have really been very bewildering to readers. Now we look at them effortlessly. You know, the jump cut, the flashback, all kinds of things which were quite complicated to do are now effortless to do. We all know what they are.
Having won the Booker of Bookers once, were you annoyed when they resurrected the competition? It felt to me like you were kind of being asked to apply for your own job.
Yeah, I thought, couldn't we wait till 50 years? That's what I thought. I'm not annoyed now. I mean, this reminds me of Kingsley Amis, who gave the all-time greatest ever Booker Prize acceptance speech. When he said, he said something like, I'm paraphrasing it, but he said, I've always despised this prize, but I've just changed my mind. So, yeah, I mean, I would have sooner, I guess, if it had been just left alone until half a century, you know. But it's all right now.
I guess at least the first time round, three former judges retired into a darkened room,
yes,
and talked about it in some mysterious fashion, whereas this time there was actually a kind of... There were readers, actually.
Yeah. No, I thought that was an interesting, you know, an interesting variation and well worth having done, I think. I mean, the three judges... Who they were, Malcolm Bradbury, who, as I say, voted for it the second time.
Didn't
vote for it when it was actually winning the Booker Prize, but voted for it for the Booker of Bookers. I think it was his apology, I guess. You know. And W.L. Webb, who for so long was the literary editor of The Guardian. And I think the third judge was David Holloway of The Bookseller.
Yeah, I can't remember.
And the reason I remember this is because he had been absolutely passionately determined that William Golding should win. I found all this out afterwards, you know. And he got outvoted. I knew none of this, you know. So I showed up for the award thing, feeling very pleased, and tried to say thank you to everybody. And when I tried to say thank you to him, he was incredibly grumpy. And I thought, why, what? You know, you just gave me this prize and I'm saying thank you. And he essentially couldn't talk to me. He was so cross. So there we are. Sorry, David.
We've got one up here.
Thank you, Simon. I was just wondering about the more sort of intimate details of how you actually write, your routines, and whether those, if you can recall, have changed over the years.
Yeah, they have changed. Like around the time I was writing Midnight's Children, I suppose I could write more in a day than I do now. But it was also much more imperfect. That book seemed to just have such an energy inside me that it would pour out, you know, but it would pour out in a very approximate way, and then I would have to fix it. Now I find that's not quite what happens. I mean, now I find that I write less in a day, I mean, considerably less in a day than I used to. But that it's when I, at the end of the day, it feels much closer to being finished. I don't feel that it needs nearly so much fixing as it used to. So I guess when you're young, the thing you have to fake is control. And when you're old, the thing you have to fake is energy. So it's just, I guess that's a change, you know, and I think it's not as simple as that, because there even more recently have been some books that seem to come more quickly. But in general, I think that has been a shift from that earlier fluency to this, I hope, slightly greater mastery of the prose. But otherwise, I just do it like a job. You know, I don't have any weird habits. I do. My weirdest habit is not getting dressed before I start writing. So I mean, I always had this superstition that you wake up every day with a little lump of creative energy, which is your creative energy for that day. You know, and that what you should do is not fritter it away doing anything else except writing, you know. So don't answer the phone, don't check your emails, don't have a shower, don't make coffee, go to your desk, sit down, start, you know. And so often, if people stumble upon me at my desk, they see this crazy person in his pajamas with his, you know, looking extremely disheveled, trying to get started, you know. And then once I feel I've got started for the day, you know, I know what I'm doing, then I can go and get dressed and have some coffee and read the paper and get back to it. But that's the only stupid trick I've got.
There's a Guardian Review article on that. Writers who started writing before they got dressed.
Yeah.
Balzac always... You know,
Balzac?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
You know,
I didn't know that.
Company, I think
Balzac did that?
Yeah, no. I haven't had this idea before. You've given
yeah.
me this.
Yeah, oh, good. That's good. No, that's good. Balzac and me. I like that. That's good.
There's a gentleman here.
Hello. I'm Demola Wiyokun, and one of the things that's fascinating, it's this quality of history to repeat itself. I think that's what gives great novels their prophetic value. One of the fascinating things about your novel is this chapter about the Commander Sabramatis Barton. And I remember few months ago when we heard this news of a couple a man that killed a wife because of an adulterous affair and things like that. And I was living quite in East London then, and every evening there was this energetic discussion, debate among people there that, no, this is right, this is wrong. The bride shouldn't have gone into an adulterous affair, shouldn't have been killed. You know, all these kind of arguments fed by idealism. And it was really parallel to what you wrote there in the Commander Sabramatis chapter. And I felt, wow, how fascinating history repeats itself. And
yeah, it does. I mean, the Commander Sabramatis chapter is one of the things that actually is based pretty directly on a historical incident. That there was a very famous murder case in Bombay in the 50s in which a naval commander, whose real name was Nanavati, Commander Nanavati, discovered that his wife, Sylvia, was having an affair with somebody else. And he went to the naval arsenal, checked out a pistol, went round to the lover's apartment, shot the lover dead, shot his wife in the stomach, went out and surrendered. And then this court case began, which, as you say, raised all kinds of huge emotions for and against. And I based the chapter in the novel is actually, or at least that the description of the court case is based quite closely on what really happened. And what I didn't know and could not foretell was the outcome of the story, which is that what happened then was that Commander Nanavati was eventually found guilty and sent to jail and served a sentence for murder. His wife, however, survived. And what was impossible to foretell was that she waited for him. And when he came out of jail, they patched it up. And they moved to Canada and lived happily ever after. That's the bit that you can't make that stuff up. I wish I could have thought of that in advance. That would, then I'd really have felt prophetic. You know? But it's a, I guess this stuff just does reenact itself, you know, in different places at different times.
The lady there.
A few questions. I was wondering.
Sorry. No, lost it. Something went wrong.
To what extent, like, being original, were you trying to rebel against the traditional English literary form and kind of make it your own as a kind of voice of India, in a way? And also, were you at all influenced by Woolf's book Orlando? Because I found a lot of the things, the more original features in your book, like things about the link with history, the kind of bending the realms of what we expect from a novel in terms of fiction, yeah. Time, transitions in the protagonist, I saw in Orlando, and I was just wondering if there was any influence there.
Gosh, I would so much like to be able to say yes, but actually at the time that I wrote Midnight Children, I had not read Orlando. So there goes a PhD thesis. you know, or not, actually.
No, you've met people.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But yes, I was feeling quite rebellious, yeah, in terms of the kind of writing that I wanted it to be. Because, I mean, even though I am an enormous admirer of E.M. Forster, and in particular of Passage to India, which I think is a, you know, brave and brilliant book, and actually, even though I was lucky enough to know E.M. Forster a little bit because he was at the same college as me. I mean, when I was an undergraduate, he was living at King's College. And I had two or three days with, you know, teas and walks and so on with him. And he was very generous and open as a person. And so I'm fond of his memory. But nevertheless, I did feel that the influence of the Forsterian tradition on the Indian novel was not entirely beneficial. That what it had done was to generate one or two generations of writing which were cool, very English, cool fiction. And I thought, if there's one thing that India is not, it's cool. You know, it's hot. And I felt that it wasn't about the content, something about the quality of the language seemed to be at odds with the place I was trying to describe. And so I thought, how could one heat it up? How do you create a hotter language? And put side by side by that was the idea of the crowd, because it seemed to me that the most obvious fact about India, other than that it's hot, is that there are a lot of people there. You know, it's a very crowded environment, and it's also very, if you like, sensually crowded. It's an assault on the senses. It's very noisy. It's very smelly. You know, the field of vision is unusually full. You know, and I thought, how do I write that? How do I write a crowd in a hot country? You know, and I really tried to make a language which felt like it was the answer to that question. I think it's quite natural and normal in literature that writers, in a way, define themselves against other writers as well as with some writers. You know, and And a thing that's happening now, I mean, I've come to see, is that people are doing to me the same thing that I did to Forster, that there are people defining themselves against me, and saying, well, that's what not to do, you know? And it's okay, I guess. I mean, having done it myself, I can't complain when somebody else does it, but it's kind of sickening.
Thank you. Yeah, you mentioned how important film is to you and to your writing. And quite some time back, a wonderful film, The Riddle of Midnight, followed you around India after you returned after even more years. I was wondering first, to what extent the riddle kind of evolved out of the issues that may have come in Midnight's Children. And the second part of the question would be, if whether you would consider, or if you did consider, a kind of return second riddle, yeah. Second round of the riddle, what sorts of issues do you think would you deal with that took place now in the past 2 decades?
Yeah, The Riddle of Midnight, for people who don't know about it, was a documentary, sort of feature-length television documentary that I made about at the time of the 40th anniversary of the independence of India, and it was, if you like, a kind of State of the Nation film, except that the decision we made was not really to talk to politicians on the whole. We did talk to one, but on the whole, to talk to ordinary people. And the trick was to use people who were the same age as the country, so to use 40-year-old people across the country to talk about what their lives had been like and what they felt was happening. But the riddle of the title was really the question of the idea of the nation. You know, like, what is it to be? What is Indianness? What does it mean? What is the idea of India, you know? And how do you resolve that? And so that was what I was trying to explore in that film. Now, I don't know, I suppose the most obvious facts about the country that one would have to look at would be, well, the enormously increased gulf between wealth and poverty. You know, the fact that India is much richer than it used to be, but also poorer. And I just think there is I like the fact that of the Indian economic boom and so on. I think I've got nothing against it, but I think if you can't combine that with an idea of social justice, so that just the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, that creates all kinds of social and political aberrations, and it's also just not fair. So that's one area that one would have to look at. And other than that, I mean, the thing that is unmistakable in India is the increase of communal violence. You know, I mean, it's only yesterday that there were these bombs. The growth of what may now be an Indian jihad. India used to always be proud of the fact that Indian Muslims didn't get involved in that kind of language. But now it seems that there may be at least some small percentage of Indian Muslims that is involved in violence, which is, you could argue, is an answer to the much greater violence of the Hindu nationalist majority. But for however you argue it, what is unarguable is that there is a return of communalist tension and violence in India that perhaps one wouldn't have put so much at the center of the story 20 years ago. So something like that. Actually, you know, I was interested to make Riddle 2. And such are the changing nature of television times that this time we couldn't find anybody to put up the money. You know, it's just, this is I don't know, maybe they just didn't want me to do it, but it seemed to me to be also an indication of a general dumbing down, you know. That just nobody was interested. Or at least the amount of money they were willing to put up was so small that we felt we couldn't do the job properly. You know, and so we opted not to do it.
Hi. One of my favourite of your novels is Fury, which hasn't been mentioned yet, in which the main character, Solanka, creates a doll that becomes completely out of control. And I was just wondering if you ever felt yourself that any of your characters or the stories themselves became, you know, very much to life and did go beyond your control as a writer.
Yeah. I mean, there's this novel called The Satanic Verses, which I think did exceed my ability to control its meanings. And that, I think, probably has something to do with the bit of fury that you refer to. Because interestingly, the idea of the doll maker was an idea that I'd had, I mean, many, many years before I wrote that novel. I mean, maybe 25 years before, when I was quite young, and I tried to write this story about this man who, I mean, to put it simply, was good with dolls and bad with people. And I couldn't make it work. And I put it to one side. And then when I was writing Fury, this novel about this kind of grumpy, angry person walking around Manhattan, I suddenly thought, oh, you're the doll maker. That's who you are. You're that guy. And one of the reasons that I was able to enter into it then was because, precisely because of the question you asked, precisely because I'd had some real first-hand experience of what it means to lose control of your creation, of what it means to make something with your, if you like, with your best ability, and then to have it taken away and remade and retold and reinterpreted and made to mean all manner of things which were not in your mind to do. And it was shocking to me when it happened to me. And so, yeah, I think Professor Salanka and his dolls comes directly out of what happened to me with the Satanic Verses. Yeah.
Maybe that's also a good place, an appropriate place to end. You know, he's gone way beyond the call of duty, expectable authorial stamina, and he's given a fantastically interesting...
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.